Mr. Blum, welcome to WBAI.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Great. And maybe we'll begin. It was a very interesting article that you wrote where you basically say that what neither side in this fight, in these contentious hearings, is likely to mention is something even deeper and more vital to the future of American law than the elevation of a single justice, namely that Kavanaugh's confirmation will mark the triumph of a conservative legal counter-revolution aimed at neutralizing the use of law as an instrument of progressive social and economic reform. How did we get to that situation, and why are we there?
Well, courts have always been contentious branch of government since the founding of the Republic. If you go back to the early days of the Republic, the battles between the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans often focused on staffing the courts and who would control that process. So it's really a long-standing theme in American history, but more recently, dating back to, say, the 1960s, the 1970s, in reaction to what a lot of legal scholars call the Warren Court Revolution. That's the Supreme Court under the stewardship of the late Chief Justice Earl Warren, moved American constitutional law in a liberal and progressive direction on a variety of fronts. You have Brown versus Board of Education, you've got the Miranda case, you've got Griswold versus Connecticut, you've got all the apportionment cases, Baker versus Carr, and the American right eventually determined that they needed to get organized and reassert their authority over the courts. And there isn't any precise date when this new conservative movement began, but it's called the counter-revolution in reference to the Warren Court Revolution. And a lot of people use that term. I'm not the first person to coin it. So one of the seminal texts, and I mentioned this in the piece, was the late Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell's 1971 secret memo written on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce, in which he urged American business leaders to get with it, to start hiring lawyers, to start matching the ACLU and the NAACP Inc. Fund in terms of their ability to select good cases to champion before the Supreme Court, and to get the best lawyers in the land to argue them. So it's a long-standing process that's been going on. And one of the primary organizations behind that process has been the Federalist Society, formed in the early 1980s and now has achieved such great prominence that one of its executive vice presidents, Mr. Leonard, has become a Trump advisor and has his ear on all of his judicial appointments, including Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, and, of course, many judges to the lower federal courts. So this is a very serious process, very long-standing development, and it's one that progressives need to be aware of and need to dig in and be ready to counteract and do it not just in the short term, but over the long haul.
How did progressives allow a situation to develop where we went from where we had like the Thurgood Marshalls and we had the voting rights and all the other decisions that, you know, that really started to slowly address hundreds of years of inequalities in American society and past judicial decisions like, you know, no black man has a right that a white man might respect, or that people should be segregated in schools. We went from decisions that were like that. And before that, I thought we had even more. You know, let's go back in the history, the early days of the court. We had the removal of Native Americans from Georgia, ordered by the president, when the court actually told the president he couldn't do that, and the president ignored the court.
Well,
how do we get to that? To this?
How do we get to that point?
To this point?
Well, I think that part of it's a very complicated question. Part of the answer has to do with the weakness of the Democratic Party and how they have abandoned their progressive base. But you mentioned, among many other points, Thurgood Marshall. You know who replaced him on the court? Clarence Thomas. why do we have Clarence Thomas on the court? There's somebody very prominent in the Democratic Party who arguably could have stopped Clarence Thomas, and that's Joe Biden. But he decided that he wouldn't call all of the sexual harasser accusers to testify when they reopened the confirmation hearings with Thomas. So there's a lot of broad trends and a lot of particular incidents which led us to where we are now. I think one of the broader trends that has gotten us to where we are, is that the right really played a long game. When the Federalist Society was formed, it was really the brainchild of three very bright conservative law students who then got professors to mentor them, including Antonin Scalia at the University of Chicago. They knew that this was going to take decades, and they knew that they had to work at the local level, appointing judges, getting judges appointed at the district court level federally and also throughout the various state systems. And they weren't assured of victory, but you have to hand it to them in a certain sense, because they understood that this was a meticulous step-by-step battle. And right now, it is all paying off for them in the most ironic and horrific of circumstances, with the election of Donald Trump, who has gotten support from movement conservatives who might otherwise abhor him, because he's promising them a basket of goodies, including a big tax cut for the rich and further appointments to the Supreme Court and to the lower federal courts. And Trump is really racking up a number of appointments to the federal courts, particularly to the courts of appeal at a record clip for someone who's only been in office less than 2 years. And recently, I don't know if you've read this, but Schumer and McConnell agreed to approve another 15 or 16 Trump lower court appointees with no further discussion or floor fights. So the Democrats continue, in my view, not to put on the kind of fight that they should have put on. Mm-hmm. You know, we had the nomination of Merrick Garland, and you know, maybe Merrick Garland wouldn't have been confirmed, but I don't think a great big fuss was created when the Republicans refused even to give him a hearing. So there are many factors behind the rise of the conservative judicial counter-revolution, but here we are. We're in the midst of it, and we have a confirmation hearing for a judge who is rated by many legal academics who, when he gets on the court, he will be the second most conservative member of the court after Clarence Thomas, and he'll be in a cluster of hardcore conservatives with Alito and with Gorsuch. And we on the left have to understand just what we're up against. This is it's no laughing matter, and it's nothing that we can ignore, and I don't think we've paid enough attention to it.
I've heard it referred to that this Kavanaugh is the linchpin of Trump's fascist agenda. Would you know that?
Well, you know, I don't know whether he's the linchpin. There may be others, but he's certainly an important cog. I'm looking at a chart created by some academics who try to measure the ideologies of current Supreme Court justices empirically. And they have, to the right of center, Roberts, but then clustered together, Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Thomas, in that order, in terms of how right-wing they are. And then Kennedy was on this measurement. They had him slightly left of center. I think that's probably not where I would put him, but there's a huge change between Kennedy and Kavanaugh. And I think we're in for some dark days ahead, and we have to buckle up and get ready to fight this. There are many fine lawyers on the left, but we need to take this fight for judges quite seriously, and I don't think we did that very effectively in the last election, and I don't know whether we're going to start to in the future.
Let's talk for a moment about the Federalist Society and about the dark money that lies behind it. At one point today during the hearings, I think it was Senator Whitehouse, actually listed, put up a list for everybody to see of where the donors come from. And it was like a SCAFE, Koch, 13 anonymous contributors. And because of the way the laws have been interpreted by the previous Supreme Courts, nobody knows how much money is being donated. Nobody knows who's donating all of it. And is there an overlap between the people who were paying for the ads to get Kavanaugh appointed in the first place that were sprinkled all throughout the country and the Federalist Society itself?
Well, I don't know that there's a direct link between that group, which is running those silly ads in support of Kavanaugh. You saw the same ads on behalf of Gorsuch, but I think they're certainly like-minded, and it is the dark money crowd. And also, that crowd gives money openly. You know, you've got the Kochs and their Freedom Partners group, which gives a tremendous amount of money. These are the same people who've been funding groups like the Right to Work Foundation for decades. And it's a terrible problem. But what troubles me more than anything else is that or as much as anything else, is that the left seems not to be focused on the importance of the third branch of government. And the third branch of government, you know, there's an old saying coming from the Federalist Papers and Alexander Hamilton that it's the least dangerous branch. I'm not so sure that I agree with that.
There was a lot of talk of Alexander Hamilton, and in particular, something about common sense and applying common sense to the law. In legal terms, what does it mean when everybody's fawning over this Hamiltonian concept of common sense?
Well, I think that what they're getting at, and what it means to me, and again, this is kind of complicated, and it takes takes place on a variety of levels. But a few of the questioners probed Kavanaugh's adherence to what's called originalist jurisprudence. And you hear a lot about originalism versus living constitutionalism, and Kavanaugh kept repeating references. And I have to hand it to him, he's a pretty smart guy, and he knows his constitutional history. He kept referencing various Federalist papers to support his interpretation of how the Constitution ought to be read. And it's really interesting to see how originalism as a theory of constitutional interpretation has evolved over the years. Originalism helped undo Robert Bork's nomination in 1987. And Bork was what scholars call originalist 1.0, where he said we should interpret the Constitution today according to what it meant to the framers. That's a subjective test, and eventually people pointed out that it's impossible to know what specific framers thought about specific terms. And then there's originalism 2.0, which if you listen to Kavanaugh's answers, is what he adheres to, and that is we should interpret the Constitution according to what was the public meaning of the terms at the time that the terms were adopted. And that's a tool that Scalia tried to use in the Heller decision on the Second Amendment. And again, I think it's all result-oriented BS, because this is simply another way to arrive at preordained results where you don't want to consider the purpose and consequence of statutes. You know, if you're dealing with, say, for example, a prohibition in, say, the state of Michigan on gay marriage, which you had in the Obergefell case, and that statute comes before the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court has to decide what does equal protection and due process of the law mean? What did they mean to the framers? Well, the opponents of gay marriage said, well, the framers never understood that there was a right to same-sex marriage, so therefore we have to vote it down. Whereas, and this is a Kennedy majority decision, really has a very good exegesis of what we call the living Constitution, because the term equal protection has to be read in terms of contemporary values and evolving standards of decency. And that, they would argue, is what the framers actually had in mind. So it's really kind of complicated. These are sort of code words, in my mind, for how judges justices now in the Supreme Court operate. And I heard at one point Kavanaugh say today, quoting Elena Kagan, well, we're all originalists now. Well, to a certain extent, that's true, but it's also misleading. Every justice on the Supreme Court looks to the text of the Constitution, looks to the history of the Constitution, but some of them also examine the purpose and consequences behind the terms. And originalists, at least the hardcore ones like Kavanaugh, don't. And if you go back and you check his testimony, he never uses those two other tools, purpose and consequence. He talks about text, history, tradition, and precedent. Precedent, of course, being the wobbly one there. Uh-huh. And I think that Kavanaugh will be another wrecking ball alongside Gorsuch, Alito, and Thomas, and I don't know where they're going to lead this country. I think they're going to lead it, in part, back to what I call a new Lochner era, L-O-C-H-N-E-R, after the Supreme Court case from 1905, Lochner versus New York. That's when the court was dominated by this laissez-faire liberty of contract ideology, which put business interests above all others on the theory that the Constitution, that it's one of its fundamental purposes is to protect property rights. And I think we're going back there. And I think we're going back there rather rapidly. Another interesting point, however, is that the general public isn't going back there. So we're going to reach a stage, I think, where the Supreme Court begins to issue more and more unpopular decisions, sort of what was happening in the early New Deal, which forced a change in the court. You know, when Roosevelt threatened to pack the court and expand it from nine justices to get around a bunch of rulings that invalidated early New Deal programs. I think we're looking at something like that again. And the specific areas that we might see it in are in workers' rights. You know, we had the Janus case last term. We're going to see it with abortion rulings. We're going to see it with net neutrality. We're going to see it with discrimination cases, voting rights cases, a whole variety of areas that are just vitally important to people.
Right, and things like when they look at the cost of something, the cost benefit analysis,
where they say
a few people might die from dumping toxic waste here, but look how much money we save by not having to pay a normal toxic waste.
And that calls to mind another school of jurisprudence called law and economics, which even predates the Federalist Society and the Powell memo. That some people cite as the beginning of the modern conservative legal movement. You know, this cost-benefit analysis, which doesn't really consider the well-being of the greater portion of the population.
Right. It's a mechanistic thing that human life is debased, even as they talk about the sacredness of the unborn fetus. What do you think will be Kavanaugh's effect? Do you believe him when he says he's a man of precedent and he will not change Roe v. Wade?
Well, it's hard to... No, I don't. Once they get on the Supreme Court, they're not bound by any precedent. Precedent is only advisory to the Supreme Court justices. It's binding on lower court justices and judges. And as a lower court judge, Kavanaugh had to fit his decisions within the framework of Supreme Court rulings. Of course, there's a lot of wiggle room because Supreme Court rulings aren't always directly controlling of all fact situations that come before an appellate court. So they then have to reason by analogy to the closest existing Supreme Court precedent. And as Kavanaugh has his tenure unfolded, and he's been on the D.C. Circuit since 2006. He's just amassed a tremendously conservative record, and his interpretation of Supreme Court decisions tends to be very right-wing. I wouldn't trust that he will not overturn precedent. I think that he's being somewhat careful in his responses when he says that he'll respect precedent. Well, lots of people can respect a doctrine and then discard it. He's not promising that he won't depart from precedent.
I see. Anything, we have a minute or two left. I just want to wrap up by where you think this is going. If you have any ideas of how we could get around this, I mean, should they put a term limit on a Supreme Court justice?
Well, that would take a constitutional amendment.
Yeah,
I think that's highly unlikely. We only have 27 amendments in our history. So I think that would be a good idea. I think that, you know, the Republicans have gotten very smart. It used to be that you could, that the vetting process wasn't as thorough. And so people like Souter and John Paul Stevens, Republicans could get nominated and confirmed and then move to the left. That doesn't happen anymore. The vetting is very, very good. And these are lifetime appointments. The average tenure on the Supreme Court in recent decades is 26.2 years, and I think it might even go up with these youngsters, relative youngsters, like Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. Gorsuch is, I think, just 50. Kavanaugh's 53. They could be on the court for another three decades. So it matters who wins the presidential elections. That's a big, big takeaway. And while I was no fan of Hillary Clinton, I don't think that we'd get these sorts of judges from her. And I don't want to relitigate the 2016 elections and just how horrendous a candidate I think she was. But presidential elections matter because the Supreme Court is one of the goodies that you get by winning the election. And most Supreme Court nominations are approved. And that's a sad takeaway. So I think we're in for some dark days ahead, but it's not the end of days, and we have to fight back. You never know who's going to retire next. You never, although most of the older members of the court right now are Democratic appointees, but you never know.
We're in a very frightening situation, but what you're saying is don't give up hope. We have to keep at it and not become full of despair.
But also we can't be complacent, and we can't be Pollyannish either. This problem isn't going to solve itself. We have to solve the problem, and we have the capacity to do that, but it's going to take some time now.
All right,
to be patient like the right has been patient.
I see, and build something. Very good. Build a movement. Thank you very much, Bill Blum, a former judge and death penalty defense attorney. And he wrote an article, Brett Kavanaugh and the Triumph of the Conservative Revolution, in Truthdig, truthdig.com. Check it out, .org.
Truthdig.com.
Truthdig.com. Check it out. All right. Thank you very much for that and for your time.
Thank you.